From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. It's the first day of June, and we are that much closer to choosing a new president. Have you decided yet who you'll vote for? A lot of people have decided who they will not vote for. We'll talk about a social movement that champions the downfall of one of the top candidates. And we'll spend some time with Sean King, the Atlanta-based activist and columnist, sees an uncertain future for the Democratic Party. And that's despite the fact that he's impressed by Bernie Sanders' grassroots credentials.
He was a real activist in the 1960s. Like that, not that he was a pretend activist or considered it. Did you know that this guy was leading sit-ins? He was leading protests. Did you know that this guy was being chained to women in protests in inner city Chicago, that he was the head of a chapter of SNCC? I didn't know that stuff. I didn't know.
That's coming up. First, though, let's return to a recent conversation. It was about democracy and whether ours is sustainable or doomed to perish. We spoke with political scientist Michael Evans of Georgia State University about the theory that a Donald Trump presidency would mean the fall of democracy as we know it.
For the question of whether our democracy is about to die and whether we're whether Trump presents the real threat of a tyrant, I think is very far-fetched. I mean, you have to look at the institutional framework, the fact that we have the separation of powers, the fact that we have civilian control of the military and a military that is indoctrinated into a strong respect for the rule of law and democracy and for the Constitution. Someone who has authoritarian tendencies and who embraces political violence the way that Donald Trump does, I think that they can be very damaging. I think that they are antithetical to a lot of our highest democratic ideals, but I don't think that they present a threat.
Okay, so here are your first thoughts. Jason Ganesh tweets, democracy, like other power regimes, will see its end. The United States moves more and more to oligarchy. Congress equals vote brokerage firm. And Anne wrote to us to say, I think the problem with our current frenzy around this election may be anger, as Bill O'Reilly said, but I think that what has caused the anger is fear. We always love getting your thoughts, so tell us what they are. Call us at 404-500-9457. You can tweet us at OSD Talk or post on the Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. We've talked before about the hashtag #NeverTrump movement. That was for mostly Republicans who decided to publicly vow they would never support Trump in his run for president. Now, there's a similar social movement, and it sprouted up around another candidate, Never Hillary. It's used by both Republicans and Democrats to protest Hillary Clinton's candidacy. But when Democrats use it, it takes on a unique meaning. John R. MacArthur is one of those Democrats. He's the publisher of Harper's Magazine and author of the book The Selling of Free Trade, NAFTA, Washington, and the Subversion of American Democracy. Thanks for joining us, John.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Scott Brown. He's an activist and volunteer with Bernie Sanders' campaign here in Georgia. Hi, Scott.
Hey, thanks for having me, Celeste.
So, John, the Never Hillary movement, I guess we can take it at its face, meaning that even with Donald Trump as the only other viable candidate for president, you would not vote for Hillary Clinton.
No, I can't, because it would be so intellectually dishonest for me, because everything I know about the Clintons, and again, when I say I can't vote for Hillary, it's what I really mean is I can't vote for the couple, for Bill and Hillary, because they're inseparable. You cannot take Hillary out of the context of Bill Clinton and his policies in the 90s. And so what I'm really saying is I can't vote for Clintonism. And everything I know about Clintonism and about Bill and Hillary Clinton starts with my book about NAFTA. And NAFTA is the template. It's the template for Clintonism. In other words, it's all about political expediency. Bill Clinton comes into office in 1993 with all sorts of exciting promises, including universal health care. And what does he do right off the bat? The first thing he does is ram a piece of legislation down the throats of traditional Democrats, union Democrats, working class Democrats, that's initiated by a Republican, by George Bush, his predecessor, President Bush. And that's NAFTA. And NAFTA is all about Bill Clinton trying to move the Democratic Party, and he successfully did it, to the right.
Now, we're going to
less dependent on labor unions and more accessible to big business and big finance.
Okay, we're going to go a little further into why it's fair to pair Hillary with her husband. But let me bring Scott into this, because as I understand it, you didn't start out. There's another phrase that encompasses never Hillary, and that's Bernie or bust, right?
Yeah.
But you didn't start out as being among that group. What changed your mind?
Really just the whole campaign, this whole primary season, from really a lot of what it is with me, and I think most Bernie or bust and never Hillary people, is just the unfairness that we feel like we've seen through this whole campaign ever since Bernie announced, and basically how he had no coverage last year, the way there's tons of things, everything from the media to the way Hillary, you know, acted in the debates to her surrogates. You know, they just, and even now at this point, when she claims she's got the nomination wrapped up, she's offering no olive branch. She's offering nothing to Bernie supporters that should, you know, expect us. She's just saying, you know, it's me or Trump, so you got to go with me. Bernie supporters, get on board. I'm not offering you anything. And that's really the feeling that we're getting. So
that sounds like you're holding her. Now, John is holding her responsible for everything that happened during the Clinton administration. It sounds to me like you're holding her responsible for everything that's happening during this election, including what the media does and what, say, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the head of the Democratic Party, does.
I think all of it factors in, though. I mean, definitely, you know, the issues and, you know, a lot of things that happened in the 90s, trade and criminal justice reform and, you know, neoliberal policies. That all factors in, definitely. Those are huge issues. And, you know, everyone might have a certain issue, a certain reason they can't, you know, vote for Hillary. But and that all factors into it, too. And a lot of, you know, what happened in Honduras and, you know, with her basically allowing the coup and then basically supporting the coup underhandedly through, you know, we've seen through the State Department, you know, leaks. And then, you know, 2014 telling, you know, the children fleeing, you know, a war zone, or, you know, as refugees, basically to go back to their country and, you know, deal with the drug cartels who might try to make you sell drugs for them or kill you otherwise. And that's, she basically, that was a big thing for me, where I was like, at that time, you know, before I was ever pro-Bernie, before Hillary was there. So that was definitely, I definitely had problems, but also there is the lesser of two evils argument. I think that's definitely fair. We have
We're going to get into lesser of two evils. Let me play you, John, this comment from Cenk Uygur of the Young Turks. He's not been a Clinton supporter, but here's what he says about the coming election.
You know, if it's Trump versus Hillary Clinton, that's not a hard question for me. I'll vote for Hillary Clinton. And then I will fight her every single day.
Yeah.
And I have no qualms about that. In a race, in a general election race, I will make the argument on the show that Clinton is better than Trump, because that is what I believe.
Is Clinton, John, not better than Trump?
I don't think it's a fair comparison. I think the Clintons, or Hillary Clinton, have done so much damage, not only to the Democratic Party, but to the American working class, that you could almost say that Trump is a result of Clintonism, that Trump grows out of Clintonism. In other words, you got two people who pretend that they're liberals. I mean, because these are people who go back to the McCarthy-McGovern campaigns of 68, 72. They'll always flash their liberal progressive credentials. But, of course, they're two-faced. They're double talkers. They're the ultimate double talkers. And eventually people aren't stupid. They aren't stupid. And eventually they wise up and they say, you know, we're not going to put up with this anymore. And along comes a guy like Trump saying, hey, I can't be bought. I'm so rich, you can trust me, which is absurd. But nevertheless, and I'm against free trade, and I'm against these lousy trade deals that have sent your jobs to China and Mexico, and I'm against the invasion of Iraq, which Hillary Clinton voted for. And they say, finally, a guy who says what he believes in, somebody who agrees with me. He confirms the feelings I've been having. Now, a lot of these people are also for Bernie Sanders. I mean, the amazing thing about this campaign is the crossover of support between Sanders and Trump supporters. You've got, I haven't seen the best polling on it, but a great number of people say that they will, if they can't vote for Sanders, they'll vote for Trump. If they can't vote for Trump, they'll vote for Sanders. This is an expression of deep, deep frustration that comes out of the Clinton double talk and the Clinton, what I call the Clinton war against the working class.
I would imagine it comes out of the past 15 to 20 years. But if you're just joining us, my guests are author John R. MacArthur and activist Scott Brown. We're talking about the Never Hillary, hashtag Never Hillary. And Sam Burnham tweets, inseparable Clintons, Clintonisms, hashtag truth. So, Scott, I want to play you this comment here from conservative author Demetrius Minor, because when we talked about the Never Trump movement, he has pledged not to vote for Trump and is considering his alternatives.
I disagree with Hillary Clinton on virtually everything. I am a conservative. But what I respect about Hillary Clinton is that she doesn't pretend to be a conservative. And Donald Trump, I think his character, I think he's irrational. I think he's politically unstable. And I fear a Trump presidency more than a Hillary presidency, because with Hillary Clinton, I know what I'm getting.
So you mentioned the lesser of two evil arguments, and here we are, because this is the essential question, right? Not voting for Hillary gives a chance that Trump may get, you know, enough votes to win.
Well, no, I'm hoping.
Wait, hold on 1 second, John. Scott?
Yeah. I think.
Don't know what to say to that.
One of the big reasons I think, you know, there's one of the reasons I'm not 100% never Hillary, but I'm 99% there, especially being not in a swing state. And I think one of the big reasons is that if we vote for Hillary, you know, I don't really know what we're getting. The similarities between Trump and Hillary is I don't really know what either of them is going to do in office. I don't know what their actual beliefs are. I don't know what their philosophical foundations are, because, you know, for different reasons. I mean, Trump just seems like a total phony. I mean, he's total just see through him, but he's, you know, completely malleable. He'll contort himself however he needs to.
He does change his positions a lot.
And Hillary, you know, she's a little more calculated, but she's always looking for the political expedient route, and the way, you know, she's always worried about what Republicans are going to do as a backlash. And in a way, I'm not sure what either of them would do. And, you know,
it sounds like you haven't decided what you're still mulling it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I'm going to vote for her. I don't really think she can win, and we're not a swing state, so, you know, maybe my presidential vote would be better.
You don't think she could win Georgia?
No, and I don't think she can win. I think it's going to be tight in the general election, and I'm not sure. I think we've been underestimating
Trump. Well, then we have about a couple minutes left, John, and that's the argument that a lot of people would make to you, which is that it could be that the election is tight. Are you willing to risk a Trump presidency?
Oh, yeah, because he's unpredictable. The Clintons are utterly predictable. You're going to get more terrible trade agreements. You're going to get more military intervention overseas, which ends up hurting the working class. You know, one of the points I always make is the people who support Trump are supposed to be stupid or crazy, right? And they're not stupid. They know that the Clintons' kid and son-in-law didn't fight in Iraq. It's the working class kids who go to Iraq and get wounded or killed. And so at least Trump is unpredictable in the sense that, you know, maybe he'll cut the right way and he won't do the wrong thing. With Hillary Clinton and Bill at her side, you can be sure you'll get more of the same that you had from the 90s. As my friend here, Scott, just said, she's promised Sanders nothing. And in fact, the Clintons are quite vengeful. They're vindictive people and will actually take it out on the Sanders wing of the party. They're not going to appease the Sanders wing. They're going to punish the Sanders wing. That's the way that they operate in politics. They're very mean. So I don't see a Clinton victory as a lesser of two evils. I see it as a guarantee of a continuation of policies that have done immense damage
to
the United States.
We'll have to end it there. That's John R. MacArthur. He's publisher of Harper's Magazine, author of the book The Selling of Free Trade, NAFTA, Washington, and the Subversion of American Democracy. Scott Brown is an activist and supporter of the Bernie Sanders campaign here in Georgia. Scott and John, thank you.
Thanks for having me. Can I say one last thing?
It's On Second Thought. Most people avoid publicizing their political opinions, but Sean King makes a living off of his. The New York Daily News columnist writes almost daily, two articles a day, I've heard, about presidential politics and all kinds of other subjects. He often wears his political affiliation right there on his sleeve. But he's a lifelong Democrat, and he's made a decision to soon sever ties with that party. Sean King's based in Atlanta and joins me now in our studio. Welcome.
Yeah, good to see you.
It is still correct that you plan to leave the Democratic Party after the November election?
Yeah, I do. You know, I feel like, and it really hurts me to say this, my mother's a lifelong Democrat, and I really learned about the Democratic Party from my mother. She's worked in a light bulb factory in Kentucky for the past 45 years, and she voted for Bernie Sanders as well, and she was a huge Clinton supporter and really kind of sold me on the Clintons as a teenager. I grew up in rural Kentucky, and she believed that Bill Clinton was a supporter of working class people, and here she was working in this factory, and so it made a lot of sense for her. Like she identified with Bill's kind of story of coming up rough, of struggling to get where he was, and I think she's experienced what a lot of working class people, particularly factory workers and others, have experienced, not only during Bill Clinton's presidency, but over the last 20 years of her career there in the factory. All of her benefits eroded, her pension and other things were taken away, and so here she is now, a retired woman, kind of struggling to make it from month to month. And she was surprised because, you know, here she is, my mother is a very independent woman, and she decided to support Bernie Sanders because she felt like he was for the things that she cared about.
Let's actually hear a little bit of President Bill Clinton talking from this very era that you were speaking of. This is 1996. He spoke at the University of Kentucky for his reelection bid.
I was there.
Oh, yeah. Here he is that year. This is another campaign event in Louisville.
I believe that we've got an obligation to work together to help each other make the most of our own lives. I believe that the First Lady was right when she said, "It takes a village to raise our children and to build a country." And what you have to decide is whether you think we have to do this together or whether we're better off going into the 21st century on our own.
Sean, isn't this what politics is, though? Isn't it true of every political candidate and every political party that when they get into office, the promises they made during their campaign often aren't fulfilled and that political expediency takes over?
Well, I think there's definitely some truth to that, Celeste, but what I've learned now, I was a teenager when he gave that speech, and what I've learned now is that not only did Bill and the Democratic Party, not only have they consistently kind of overpromised and underdelivered, I don't really even believe that they believe a lot of the things that they're saying. Like, just last night I shared a video about how Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who's the head of the DNC, that she's received huge amounts of money from payday loan companies, and she's introduced, you know, legislation supporting payday lenders. And so in the communities that I fight for and care about, they are struggling with these payday loan companies, and people are in deep debt. They charge sometimes over 300% interest. And to find that not only, it's not just Debbie Wasserman Schultz, but a lot of the Democratic congressmen that I loved and respected, like Alcee Hastings and Gregory Meeks, these are members of the Congressional Black Caucus, have received hundreds of thousands of dollars from these payday loan companies to make sure that legislation never comes up to kind of curb their influence. And so I'm against the death penalty, and Hillary Clinton is for the death penalty. I'm against these payday loan companies. I'm against, in so many ways, I'm against unnecessary war. And the Democratic Party can no longer clearly say, hey, we're an anti-war party.
Hillary Clinton voted for the Iraq War. But to a certain extent, the party that you're describing, that you would be a member of, doesn't exist.
Right.
And Bernie Sanders is an independent, which is one of the problems that many people had for him, is he's running as a Democrat, but he legislates as an independent. So where do you go? If your party doesn't exist, where do you go if you leave the Democrats?
Right. I think that's the dilemma, and that's what's so frustrating. And I think the fact that Bernie Sanders has won 21 primaries and caucuses has kind of shocked the soul of the Democratic Party. I mean, not one governor in any of those states endorsed him. Not one U.S. senator in any of those states endorsed him. And so in spite of the entire Democratic machine being against him, he continued to win state after state after state, and even now he is competitive in California because a lot of people, just like me, look not just at Hillary Clinton, but look at the Democratic Party, and they're frustrated. And we see Bernie currently as our only option to express that frustration. But for me, I'm no longer willing to play the game. I should be able to support candidates who believe what I believe, who support what I support, and I should not have to hold my nose and vote. And so for me, I'm just done playing that game.
Okay. There's a name that has not come up yet, and it's an important name. So let's hear a bit of you speaking to NPR. This is in 2008. It was the night that Barack Obama won the presidency. And here you are reacting to that news.
Yeah.
I'm great. I'm excited. I'm on cloud nine, really. My wife is about 6.5 months pregnant, and we have some little ones. And so we decided to go very low-key, and we're still here in the house. And so we turned down a couple party invitations and made it private, but that allowed me to kind of let my guard down and cry a little bit. Barack Obama didn't just do this on his own, and he knows that. He really stands on the shoulders of so many people that came before him.
That wasn't that many years ago, and yet this is dramatic. I mean, Barack Obama is the head of the Democratic Party right now.
Yeah, he's definitely the de facto head of the Democratic Party, and a lot of us even have to face the reality that he has empowered Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who so many people are frustrated with, and he can make huge changes with the DNC if he wanted to. I think what a lot of us, so I still support President Obama. I still love him and respect him. I'm not nearly as strong in my critique of him as like someone like Cornel West would be, but I am frustrated, not just with him, but with the reality that to be a Democrat in America requires you to compromise on so much that you care about. And I feel like he has done the best that he could in that process. But here's an illustrative point. When he came into office, he enacted a lot of policies banning the influence of lobbyists, not only in his administration, but in the DNC.
Let's just take a moment and actually listen to him saying that. This
yeah.
June of 2008, he was the presumptive Democratic nominee for president, and he said the DNC would not take money from lobbyists.
We will not take a dime from Washington lobbyists or special interest PACs. We're going to change how Washington works. They will not fund my party. They will not run our White House, and they will not drown out the voices of the American people when I'm president of the United States of America.
So what happened then?
It's huge to me.
Yeah.
And when I hear that clip, I don't believe he's selling wolf tickets. I don't believe he's lying to us. He meant it. And when he came into the White House, he put in some really strict policies about the influence from lobbyists. And at least in the White House, he's tried to keep to some of those things. But the DNC, and anybody that's listening to this could Google it, the DNC, piece by piece, has taken away all of the policies and restrictions that he put on lobbyists. And the DNC, they now take huge amounts of money from special interest and lobbyists. So even the things that he put in place, the DNC has rolled those back. And for me, that's telling about the future of the party. And Hillary Clinton, I don't even think she would be winning right now had she not taken money from super PACs and lobbyists. She would be so far behind in the fundraising game that it would have crippled her campaign. And for those of us who see that as an essential issue, that money does influence politicians, for us it's a bit of a deal breaker. And the DNC is going in the wrong direction with that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is New York Daily News senior justice writer Sean King. And we would love to hear from you. And we wonder if one of the two major political parties, or maybe the Libertarian or Green Party, actually accurately or closely represents your own ideas and beliefs. You can tweet us now at OST Talk. So the question for me is that, and let me play you a comment from the former U.S. Labor Secretary Robert Reich. He served in the Clinton administration. He says that what we're seeing right now is sort of a sea change in the Democratic Party. Here he is speaking with radio host Tom Hartman.
We've got to pay more attention to this upsurge around the country of people who feel, not only feel that the game is rigged and know the game is rigged, but also feel that they don't have an opportunity to get ahead. Their children have even less of an opportunity. People who have less job security than they've ever had in living memory. And people, average, typical families of this country who are actually worse off than they were in the year 2000. If we want to win elections as Democrats, we have got to change our tune.
Because it sounds like he's talking about you and your mother, and I wonder if there isn't actually an opportunity here, especially with the rise of the Bernie Sanders campaign. Perhaps Bernie is a crucible for change, and this is a moment when it might be an opportunity to really bring about substantive change in the DNC.
Listen, I still hope that happens. Like, I have no idea what the next 2 months are going to hold. Like, I don't know if Bernie wins California, say he wins it by a point, or say he wins it by 5 points, what impact will that have? Or will the DNC move forward as it feels like they're doing now, and with kind of a disrespectful tone and slight towards the Sanders campaign? I don't think anybody would argue the Democratic establishment is kind of firmly against Bernie Sanders. Almost almost no governor, no senator, no congress people, you know, they're completely against him. Even almost every mayor of every major city has endorsed Hillary Clinton. And so my skepticism leads me to believe that the next 2 months are going to be a big disappointment. But even in part of my announcement was to say, after this election, I am moving on and considering other options. But my gut tells me that these next few months are going to be a deep disappointment to those of us who support Bernie and the things that we care about most, including Bernie himself, are going to continue to be slighted by the party.
You know, I mean, I read a lot of your writing, and I know that you don't very often prognosticate. You don't often make predictions about the future. But we are. I wonder what you think about the moment where we are right now. This very conversation that we're having about the identity of the Democratic Party is one that many Republicans are having with the rise of Trump. Could this be a moment in which we do get some viable third parties, in which we see other major parties rise?
Well, I think every poll and, you know, every bit of research tells us that people now are more open to voting for a third party candidate than they ever have been in the modern history of this country. And that's on the Republican side and the Democratic side. But people are really nervous about taking that step. Like all of us, in probably including you and I and people listening, in a sense, we're kind of addicted to the Democratic and Republican parties. It's what we know. It's what we've always done. Yet every poll shows that both of these candidates are the two most disliked candidates to ever get to this point. And so I think people are begging, basically, for another option. And if we were ever going to do a serious new third or fourth party, like, I wish we had a four-party system where Republicans felt like they had two options and Democrats felt like they had two options, where there was a more progressive Democratic option and a more moderate Democratic option, and the same thing for Republicans. I think that would be a fair fight. Like, I think right now, Democrats and Republicans, those of us who are disaffected and frustrated, are playing a bit of a game of chicken. Like, I think if Republicans believed that they were going to start a credible third party on their own, they're going to hold back because they feel like, hey, if we start this, we're going to ruin it for any other Republican candidate. And the Democrats are doing the same thing, where they're afraid to start a credible third party because they think, hey, that means giving the campaign to Trump. But if the Republicans, if disaffected Republicans and Democrats each started their own credible third party and we had a credible four-party system, I think we'd have a lot more balance there.
So I want to read a couple things people have tweeted to you in the two or three minutes we have left.
Sure.
Reliable Friends tweets, Sean King assessment may be correct, not his conclusion. He should strive to correct the party's foible from inside. And Nikki Salcedo says, with that rationale, I couldn't watch movies or enjoy sports or buy clothes or eat at any restaurant.
I don't know about that. I don't know.
It's because we said that you can't separate the candidate's politics from her husband's in the 1990s and how you get politics out. What do you think? I mean, that especially to this comment that you should be striving to correct the party's foibles from inside it.
Well, I think somebody should be doing that. I think I support the notion that we need great people inside of party politics fighting to change it. But I also love the notion that there are people outside of the party. I think Robert Reich is someone that I admire a great deal, is probably a great example of that, is somebody who spent his entire life really inside of the Democratic Party establishment, who has now kind of made a slight pivot and has positioned himself outside of the party. And it was really even when I read a piece from him saying, listen, if Bernie loses, I still want you to fight for Bernie all the way to the end. This was what Robert Reich said.
Yeah.
But if he loses, I would prefer for you to vote for Hillary because we have to defeat Trump. But if Hillary wins, you should seriously consider starting a third party to fight back not only against her but against the Democratic Party. And so,
is that your plan?
Yeah, that's my thought. You know, I don't see a way. Like, I won't campaign for Hillary Clinton. I am one of those voters who is really here to fight more against Donald Trump, particularly if Bernie, it would take a miracle for Bernie to win at this point. It would take some type of revolution or something to happen.
Yeah.
A coup for him to win at this point. But I won't actively be supporting Hillary Clinton, but I'll do everything that I can to defeat Donald Trump. And, you know, we'll see what happens.
That is New York Daily News columnist Sean King. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is On Second Thought. Look, in the past, we've already gotten ourselves in a lot of trouble over cornbread and biscuits, so we might as well head into the fire again. We're going to talk about the debate over how to serve another Southern staple. This time, grits are on the subject of conversation. How do you take yours, sweet or savory? Melted cheese, salt, butter, sugar, maybe something else? I knew somebody who put salsa on her grits. Call us at 404-500-9457 to be part of that discussion. And be sure to join us Thursday at 9 a.m. for more. A cry for help came in the form of a very shocking Twitter handle last month. A user called Raped at Spelman sent a series of messages about a violent sexual attack on the campus of Spelman College. The anonymous author accused four men from Morehouse College of rape. And the writer also accused Spelman of not responding after she reported the crime. And she said she thought the close relationship between the two historically black institutions was the reason her story was swept under the rug. Sexual violence is one of the most underreported crimes in America, and a 2014 survey by the Justice Department found only 20% of campus sexual assault victims go to the police. Survivors of color may face unique challenges in reporting rape, though, and we wanted to ask about that. We have Carolyn West with us. She's an associate professor of psychology at the University of Washington, also editor of the journal Sexualization, Media, and Society. Hi, Carolyn.
Hello.
Also with us is Christine Lindquist. She's a senior research sociologist at the Center for Justice, Safety, and Resilience at RTI. Hi there, Christine. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And Aditi Bhattacharya joins us. She is the manager of the Sexual Assault Program at the New York Asian Women's Center. Hi, Aditi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So let's go first to the numbers. And Christine, maybe you can lay out for us, are there differences between, say, instances of rape and reporting of rape on HBCUs as opposed to other campuses? Because from what I saw, very often reports come out saying that rape is significantly lower at historically black colleges.
Yeah, that's a really great question. And there hasn't been a lot of research in that area. We know that in general, between around one-fifth and one-quarter of college women are sexually assaulted during the course of their college careers. And unfortunately,
wait, I'm sorry. I just needed to pause for a second, because one-fifth and one-quarter means that one out of every four women or mm-hmm. one out of every five women are sexually assaulted while they're at college?
Yes, that's correct. There's no nationally representative studies that have been conducted recently, but a number of studies have converged sort of on that same statistic. But it is important to note that there's a lot of variation from one university to the next. We conducted a recent study with the Bureau of Justice Statistics and the Office of Violence Against Women and found that there was very dramatic variability in prevalence rates across schools. So it's important not to just assume that the statistic is 1 in 4 everywhere or 1 in 5 everywhere, but it is a very prevalent problem.
Although when you were talking about your research, you said that you used close-ended survey responses when you asked about reasons for not reporting, and so cultural reasons were not included. What does that mean?
Right. So when we conducted our study of four historically black colleges and universities, which was the largest study conducted to date, we wanted to be able to compare the experiences of women who attended HBCUs with those who attended non-HBUs. So we needed to use a methodology that we had used in a previous study that was done at traditional universities or predominantly white universities. So we used a standard set of response options to find out about reasons for not reporting. And we didn't include, unfortunately, we did not include some of the reasons that may be very prevalent at HBCU campuses. So we didn't include responses such as the code of silence related to protecting African American offenders. We didn't include response options that got at the strong black woman persona, which emphasizes resilience and self-sufficiency. And we also didn't get at any response options that had to do with mistrust of the legal system or law enforcement agencies based on historical events.
Okay, so historical events, and that brings you into this, Carolyn, because you mentioned that more black, in speaking with our producers, that more black women statistically have faced sexual assault before they enter college than white women. How does that affect what happens on college in the college campus?
Well, that certainly makes you much more vulnerable. So we do know
that. But why is that? Why does it make you more vulnerable if you have faced sexual assault before?
So there's always the possibility of revictimization. That I've done research on the topic and find that women who were sexually abused as children are at this much higher risk of being sexually revictimized in adulthood. Perhaps you drink to self-medicate, and that makes you more vulnerable to perpetrators, self-esteem issues, difficulty with sexual boundaries that make you vulnerable as well. So perpetrators actually often target women who have a history of sexual violence, and they pick up on that vulnerability, and those are the women that they target. So having a history of sexual violence prior to entering college may increase the risk that you'll be victimized once you enter college.
Carolyn, do you think we have a good picture based on the research that's been done of where women are more likely to report a rape on college campuses? What campuses, and whether that's related to race or demographics or income or anything like that?
Well, there's underreporting in general, and oftentimes young college students may not even have a language for what's happened to them. They know something's happened that they're traumatized by and upset by, but they may not initially label it rape right away or even have the language to talk about it or even know who to talk about the sexual assault, who to turn to.
Oh, I'm sorry, Carolyn. If I could just add to that a little bit about what some previous research shows about incidents that are more or less likely to be reported, because some of this speaks to what you're saying about the nature of sexual assault on college campuses. We know that it's much less likely that a victim will report the incident to the police if the perpetrator is someone that she knows, and that's very common with sexual assault. Usually the perpetrator is someone who's known.
That's true off campus. I mean, just in general, is it not?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, right. Also, when incidents are more severe, they're more likely to be reported. When incidents take place on campus, they're more likely to be reported, especially to campus police. And then one factor that's sort of a deterrent with reporting is whether alcohol or drugs are taking place.
Okay.
And we know that with campus sexual assault, a lot of this takes place in the context of alcohol. And so victims may fear that they're going to get in trouble if they report the incident to the police.
So let me bring you into this, Aditi. Is it possible that women of color, while their reporting rates are much lower on HBCUs than at other college campuses, is it possible that that is a cultural barriers preventing them from reporting, and that if those barriers did not exist, the rates of rape on an HBCU, for example, would be equal to those on any other campus?
The simple answer is yes. In my experience, and the folks that we work with, I am based out of New York City and I run a sexual violence program. Our agency, the Asian Women's Center, as the name suggests, largely works with Asian Americans and Asian Pacific Islander individuals, irrespective of gender and sexual identification, across the lifespan. And in running the sexual violence program, I naturally work a great deal with Asian youth, especially when I'm looking at campus sexual assault. And what I can tell you is, yes, the cultures that we are speaking to, and I know that we had in your earlier conversations alluded to the issue of language and the issue of the mistrust of systems. These are both cultural factors. And specific to the folks we work with, one must also understand that with immigrant youth, they're also coming from countries and cultures that have historically not trusted systems. And so to come here and to be surrounded in confusion, knowing that they have been assaulted, but not knowing how they're supposed to talk about it, who they're supposed to talk to, and what implications it will have for when their community will be told about it and when they will be outed to their own colleagues on campus and to their community off campus, these factors add a great deal of silencing and a great deal of mistrust.
My guests right now are Aditi Bhattacharya. She's the manager of the sexual assault program at the New York Asian Women's Center. Christine Lindquist is senior research sociologist at the Center for Justice, Safety, and Resilience at RTI. And Carolyn West is associate professor of psychology at the University of Washington and editor of the journal Sexualization, Media, and Society. Carolyn, a number of women at HBCUs sometimes mention the effect that reporting a rape or sexual assault may have on the male, usually male, it's not always, but usually. In other words, a fear that with that report, they would be ruining that young man's life. How do we have any way of measuring that or any way of figuring out how much that plays into whether someone reports an assault or not?
There's no real good ways of measuring that, but there have been some studies that sort of have indicated that based on interviews. That is something that happens quite a bit when you talk about these communities where there's a lot of pride in those institutions and a deep desire to protect those institutions. Women are just going to be much more reluctant, and there's going to be much more pressure not to say or do things that would jeopardize that. And so these institutions, the expectation is that we will come together to fight for racial justice. And so it makes it very difficult to talk about violence within those communities. It's much easier to talk about violence against African-American communities in terms of police brutality and that type of thing, rather than gender-based violence.
Aditi, do you see this as well with all women of color?
Do I see
this hesitance, the hesitance to report because you're afraid that it will ruin a young man of color's life, but also because it may distract from some of the bigger issues facing that community?
Of course. When you are an immigrant, and I think this cuts across all communities of color, but specifically looking at the immigrant reality, and New York is a very immigrant city. It's close villages of people who come from same countries and same quote-unquote ethnic cultures, even though there is huge diversity of socioeconomic and other backgrounds that define their cultures. These are closed villages of people, and people find out. And if I'm an individual on campus, and yes, my community is looking to me to bring pride, given my association with campus, if I end up having to report this crime committed to me, what implications will that have on how my community is viewed? What implications will that have if I am a Muslim youth from Pakistan? What implications will that have if I am a Chinese male who's been assaulted? And what will that mean for the rest of my community? What impressions will I be leaving behind with the wide diaspora, the majority culture, as regards my own community? And to your earlier point about perpetrators being punished and that concern, that is also very cultural. I can tell you in my personal work with students on campus and in my conversations with student groups on various campuses in New York City, the impetus is not punitive. Students don't want to necessarily rush at punishment. And I am speaking from personal experience talking to them. What they want is acknowledgement, and what they want is dialogue. Hmm. Nobody wants one person to be punished by getting them expelled out of campus, because that also has implications for how their peers and colleagues on campus will see them. Some do, and there is legitimacy to their desire for punishment, but I think the issue of punishment is not so black and white. It is very nuanced, just as the language of violence, of sexual violence, is nuanced.
Christine, do we know if there are things colleges can do that have been successful in increasing the number of rape reporting, or making the reporting of rape less traumatic, less of a huge, sometimes catastrophic life event for a student?
Yeah, I just want to reiterate one of the earlier points that you made, which is that sexual assault is underreported, very underreported among all racial and ethnic groups. So we have a huge problem with students not being willing to come forward. And when you talk to students about why, you know, why is it that you didn't seek help? Why is it that you didn't report this to law enforcement? There are many reasons they give. One reason that I think universities can sort of act on and develop policies related to has to do with protecting the confidentiality of victims. So one reason that a lot of victims don't come forward is because they don't want people to find out what happened. They don't want the embarrassment, the shame. They don't want everyone knowing their business. And it is possible, we've heard anecdotally, that some of this could be going on HBCU campuses, which are very close-knit and tend to have, you know, a rumor mill in circulation. People really don't want they want to know that their report is going to be kept confidential and that people aren't going to be talking about it. So I definitely think that's one thing that schools could do. They can make it easier for victims to report. They could make reporting locations more accessible. They could focus on culturally sensitive services, such as having students be able to make a report to someone who is of their same race and ethnicity. So I think there's a lot that schools can be done. And I think one important point for us to make when we're talking about, okay, well, what can we do to increase reporting, is that we have to make it a good experience for victims, because we know that disclosure isn't always positive. In our HBU study, when we asked people who did report their incident to law enforcement, you know, whether they regretted it or how satisfied they were, we found that fewer than half of sexual assault victims were satisfied with how the reporting was handled, and about 36% of women who had experienced physically forced sexual assault said that they regretted reporting the incident, and an even higher percentage of women who experienced sexual assault when they were incapacitated because of alcohol or drugs regretted reporting the incident. So it's really important that service providers and law enforcement agencies respond effectively and in a culturally sensitive manner, because victims can be re-victimized by the system through insensitive behavior and victim-blaming responses.
That is Christine Lindquist, Senior Research Sociologist at the Center for Justice, Safety and Resilience at RTI. Carolyn West is Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of Washington and editor of the journal Sexualization, Media, and Society. And Aditi Bhattacharya is the manager of the Sexual Assault Program at the New York Asian Women's Center. Thanks so much to all three of you.
Thank you very much.
That's our show for today, but as always, we love to hear your voices on these issues, especially important ones like these. And I wonder if you have ever had to report a crime, any crime, or turn in a friend or a neighbor, and I wonder what happened. What was that like, reporting a crime? Call us at 404-500-9457. I'm on Twitter, at Celeste Headley. The show is at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook. For today, that's on Second Thought. From GPB News, I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.